And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
The Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror!
How much is that doggy in the window?
Hello, goons! This month we have a fright-filled freak fest from our favorite Fulci! It's called The Beyond, and it's set in New Orleans, but it's all Italy, baby. But before we get to that, we have a sponsor for this show. Mr. Tim Elliott has a dedication for the show, but I won't be reading it. I'm going to have my talking wonder dog, Schultzy, say it. In English.
Yipe. Okay, all right, I will, okay, all right. Enough with the prodding and the shocking and stuff. That hurts. Thanks to my wife for carrying my stuff at conventions, lets me put my movie posters in the living room, and generally putting up with my hobby. I love you, Fanula. She sounds good. Okay, all right. Stop, no more shocking.
Ciao, le mie amici, and welcome back once more to the Vault of Startling Horror Monster Tales of Terror, where in this installment we'll be continuing our look at a primer of Italian horror films. And joining me, as always, are my good friends and associates. First off, Mr. Chris Honeywell.
Attack, Dickie! Attack!
And joining us as well is my good friend, the Hair Metal Hero.
Hold on a second, I got something in my eye.
Oh. And joining us, of course, as always, is my good friend, Mr. Sean Engel.
You know, I was trying to reach for this book on the top level list, and I got attacked by all these rubber spiders. I don't get it.
It was actually 100 real tarantulas and one really bad tarantula puppet.
If you can't, from that amazing intro, ascertain what we're talking about, well, we're going to be taking a look today at Lucio Fulci's 1981 film, The Beyond, known in its native Italians as La Aldalia e tu vivere nel terrore, which translates to And You Shall Live in Terror, The Beyond, and known primarily in this country by its edited title, Seven Doors of Death. Ooh. And considered by many to be Fulci's best film, but unlike Zombie, which we watched last time, this one plunges headlong into, kind of outlandish territory when it comes to actually having a narrative.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, yes.
Well, attack, Dickie, attack, yes.
I think Chris put it, or Chris Tyler put it best when he was saying this off the air, that this is basically the only note you need for this film, or what the fuck? Because, yeah. Honestly, this is one of those films that if you haven't watched any Italian horror films, if you jump into this, you're either going to be amazed or completely lost.
Well, let me ask you this. If you got the doorway to hell underneath your house, why should things make sense, I guess?
True.
And just for the sake of completeness, let me give a brief plot summary for this film. Basically, our main character, Liza, who's played by Catherine McCall, who actually appeared in all three of Fulci's Gates of Hell movies, which was very, just coincidental, I think. But anyway, Liza inherits this the Seven Doors Hotel in New Orleans, Louisiana, and is trying to fix it up. But what she doesn't realize is that back in 1927, a warlock by the name of Schweik was brutally lynched and murdered underneath the hotel, and that the hotel sits on top of one of the seven gates of hell. And so when work begins on the house, the gate of hell is opened, and when the gate of hell is opened, the dead are free to roam the earth, and all sorts of bad stuff begin going down in and around the Seven Doors Hotel. And, you know, that sounds like a basic setup for a horror film, and that's really all it is. This is a basic setup that allows Fulci to shoot different set pieces of gruesome death and zombie attack and killer spider puppets and other things of that to just pad this out into a nightmare sort of film where logic is thrown out the window because, again, hell has been unleashed on Earth and logic and the rules of physics no longer apply.
Yeah, you said at the beginning it is a nightmare, and that is exactly how this film feels. It has really no cohesive narrative. It's just one thing coming on upon another, and by the end of the film, they're walking to different places and coming into places that are in no way connected. It does definitely feel like a nightmare where you're at one point in time.
Anything
you're
can happen.
In a certain area. Yeah. It personifies that. It does a great job of getting that kind of feel across.
Well, I was starting to think, you know, the older lady and her son that live there, like the caretaker people, or I guess they were, maybe they're going to know, you know, we're going to find out at the end that they're, you know, waiting to open the gates and, you know, or all that. No explanation of what's going on. Or anything.
Yeah, and that's really what, you know, the strength of the film is that, because a lot of times you'll get films like this where crazy shit happens because the director and the screenwriter want crazy shit to happen.
Yeah.
And that's you know, viable.
I want crazy shit to happen.
Yeah.
Right. But one of the things that I've always liked about The Beyond, and directly referencing the scene that Sean was mentioning, where Liza and Dr. John leave the, you know, run through a door in the morgue at the hospital and end up back underneath the hotel, mm-hmm. is that the characters in this film recognize that things do not make sense. I mean,
And that's late in the movie, and by that point, that movie was just saying, "See, fuck it." We don't know what's going on either.
But they, you know, they acknowledge. They say this is impossible. At one point, Liza says, "I must be going mad." So things, you know, it's a lot of times things won't happen. It's just a plot hole. But here, yeah, things don't make sense. Like I said, the laws of physics no longer apply. So because of forces beyond their control, they're kind of just being toyed with. And that I mean, again, it's kind of a tenuous connection. But for me, that sells the idea of this being a waking nightmare, and there's nothing you can do about it. And just because, again, the gate of hell has been opened and it's all the proverbial hell is now spilling out of it. And really what the strength of this film is literally lets Fulci play in his playground that he works at best in, and that is in gruesome gore effects.
Oh yeah. Oh God, yes.
You know, the most gruesome thing in this was evil Pippi Longstocking, though. That's, I'm going on record right now and saying that.
Well, the scene where mom gets her head melted to pink goo, I've seen that before somewhere. I saw that scene somewhere before, and it's that's a disturbing scene. It's kind
it's
of
all disturbing.
She just
his daughter just watches.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's true.
They have a big jar of acid on the top of their shelf there in the morgue. That's what I want to know. And why doesn't it have a lid on it? There are so many, you know, host regulations that are being broken in this film. Right at the beginning, the painter is up on the scaffold, no railing on the scaffold. I see that. I mean, I work for an engineering firm. I see all the OSHA violations going on.
I was just
going to
say OSHA is not going to like this, yeah, at all. And you ain't in Italy anymore, man. You're in Louisiana.
Yeah.
Things work a little differently here.
Can I just say these are the worst Louisiana accents ever?
Yeah.
Like, I don't really think he had a... I don't know if he went to Louisiana to shoot this on location or anything.
They thank the Louisiana Film Board.
Do they? So, but
I was saying
does
the same
not,
thing. I'm like, there's no way. There's no way they filmed that.
It does not capture the feel of Louisiana at all, you know?
No.
They have the old, you know, the old plantation house and stuff. But it looks right, but he doesn't. Yeah, he doesn't have the feel for it.
Even the scene that stands out as being clearly shot on location is when they go to Jill's parents' funeral in the mausoleum. You know, because here's the thing. One of the major plot points of this film is that the basement is flooded. And any of our listeners from the great state of Louisiana will tell you that in New Orleans, no house has a basement because it's below
right.
sea level.
Right.
So of course the basement's flooded. It shouldn't have a basement. But that makes it all the funnier when they have the burial in the above ground cemetery in the rows and rows of mausoleums, which are New Orleans is famous for.
Right.
So that was clearly shot, but unlike in Zombie, where Fulci gets just enough New York to make you really think that they had a full crew shooting in New York, here you're right. We don't get much in the way of New Orleans or Louisiana in general. We do get a lot of definitely, you know, old dark house, spooky house stuff in both the hotel and then in Emily's house, which when Liza goes to it is sharply appointed and very nice and warmly lit, and then when Dr. John goes to it, it's been abandoned. Another thing, again, the characters acknowledge things don't make any sense here. Liza says, "I was in there," and John's like, "It's been abandoned."
Yep, and they're both right.
Yes.
Yeah, there's but yeah, and the... my favorite is the random line where he goes, "I'm gonna call the FBI."
And Dr. John has one of the David Warbeck, a fairly respected actor who did quite a lot of work with both in genre and non-genre roles. He was in Twins of Evil. He was in A Fistful of Dynamite. He's David Warbeck was in a lot of different films through his career. But the line that he's probably most remembered for is in this film. Which is a personal favorite of all Fulci fans, where he says, "No, Liza, I'm a doctor."
Yeah.
There must be some rational explanation for this.
No, there isn't.
Also,
God, I want a rational explanation for why there's no nudity. Right? I mean, in Zombie, he managed to get a good amount of nudity, some really nice nudity. Nothing. He's in Louisiana, it's sultry and sinful there.
There's a couple cadavers you kind of saw a little bit.
Yeah. Hero.
But, you know, the only good-looking actress in this who doesn't
Hero's
have her
the
eye.
Only guy I know is catching corpse side boob.
Score! Side wang. Side wang.
Oh.
Yep.
Swang.
Swang. Swing.
As we talked about in Zombie, Fulci still has his eye fetish in full effect here. We get a personal best for Fulci, 3 eyeballs being dismembered or destroyed in the court.
Yeah, it bothered me.
You know,
especially
but that,
the spider
that,
one.
The spider one, and here's the thing. The sequence with Martin falling from off of the ladder, and then the spiders appearing out of nowhere and tearing them apart is in one sense it's a little funny because as we've said it's a mix of live tarantulas crawling on him and then obvious model puppet tarantulas. But here, let me just give you an idea here. I described that incident of the film to my wife, who's a complete non-horror fan, doesn't want anything to do with this, you know. She's off the grid, so to speak, when it comes to horror. And every time I've done this experiment, I explain it. It's like, okay, guy, he's up on a ladder in a library, falls, he cracks his skull on the marble floor, and then giant spiders start slowly tearing apart his face. Every person to a T says, that is nasty, and they get all freaked out. So it's like, that's one of those ones where had Fulci more than, you know, $400,000 to film this film, might have ended up looking a little bit better because it certainly has the creep factor.
It still has the creep factor, even
yes,
with the, you know, I mean, it's crawling in his mouth and biting his tongue and Yeah, mm-hmm. tearing off parts of his Thanks. Ear.
Oh, he's,
not,
he's...
not realistic, you know. I mean, it, but that by that point in the film, you're not going, that's not how real tarantulas act.
I don't care, man. Everybody that's, you know, listened to this show enough knows that I don't do spiders, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Right back to our first Halloween special.
Which, if you haven't listened to it, go back and find it.
Yeah. But and it's funny, in that scene, the librarian is Lucio Fulci.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I didn't even catch that.
Little guy with the glasses is Fulci. And then, of course, earlier before that, we get the Joe the plumber, the most generic plumber of all time, who has one of my favorite line of mine when Eliza asks him, "How long will it take?" "It'll take as long as it takes." Sounds
true.
Sounds like every plumber I've ever dealt with in my life.
I just am surprised at how, like, 30 years ahead of time they got Joe the plumber right. Because they're like, the plumber's here. Hi, Joe. And I'm like, oh, my God. It's And I'm writing down in my notes, Joe the plumber. And then at some point they actually say the words, Joe the plumber. And I was just like, yes.
Well, unlike the, you know, the more famous Joe the Plumber, this poor guy gets his eyeball gouged out of the side of his face.
As far as I know, that the current Joe the Plumber is okay and still doing his thing. But yeah, this Joe the Plumber didn't get much plumbing done.
Yeah.
He got some plumbing done on him.
Yeah. And then we get, when he comes back, I love the bit we get him, when we see his corpse rising up and he's just vomiting up all that lovely goop. Mm. My actual note is lovely plumber vomit. Mm.
That's a punk rock band right there.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. See, I love the fact that the plumber came out of a tub that was filled with obviously a mass of his, you know, like back hair or whatever.
Yes.
That was hideous.
Yeah.
I like how casually that woman just reached into the nastiest black still water
ever. That was
ever.
Disgusting. That was the most disturbing thing in the movie for me, probably, other than Pippi Longstocking.
And then just sort of like shakes her hand off afterwards. That had to smell like sewer.
Yeah.
It's funny. I didn't know that was Fulci. I wrote Robin Williams, the librarian.
The only thing I picked up on was the other mortician there in the hospital was our little blonde friend from the boat captain from Zombie.
Al Cliver, Fulci regular.
That's not his real name.
Well, that's his credited name is Al Cliver. And actually what's funny is with Cliver being in this is that the role that Catherine McCall plays of Liza was originally intended for Tisa Farrow, who was the lead actress from Zombie.
Yeah.
And in a sense, that would have been neat to get the zombie connection, but I'm actually, you know, I'm almost happy to see Catherine McCall. I think she's a real good actress, and she kind of has some real good horror cred from doing all these films with Fulci. And I think she's really good in this. It's just, you know, the gal who's, she's from, you know, she's almost like Andy Kaufman used to say, I'm from Hollywood. She's like, I'm from New York, except now she's down in Louisiana and all shit's breaking loose. And, you know, just things just go from bad to worse for her through the entire film. So I feel for her, you know, I really kind of feel for her.
Yeah.
I got to say again, awesome music, though. I love the music. Super cheese.
It's super cheese.
Fabio Fritzi again doing the music as he would for most of Fulci's horror output. And the great use in this of the children's choral voices. Especially at the very end, that has been one of my favorite pieces. But even then, even just the pickups and the synth music just really kind of hammers home the mood for most of this film.
Well, speaking of children's choral in the very end of the movie, it got another big bonus point for me for, oh my God, how often do you see such a great little girl shot to the head, bullet wound to the head scene?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Holy
Jill's
cow.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, what's funny about that is that, in one sense, John uses the scientific method with the zombies, because he gets his gun and he shoots the first guy in the stomach and then shoots him in the stomach again.
Yeah, but
again,
then he doesn't learn from the scientific
method. No, he doesn't.
Exactly.
About a minute, because they're right when Liza goes up the elevator and he's stuck. Then he does headshot. But then he goes right back to trying to shoot him in the stomach again. It's like, come on, man. What's the point of having a theory, testing your hypothesis, and then repeating and proving your results if you don't act on that?
Worst scientist ever.
Yep.
Yes.
And he was the one saying, I'm a scientist and a doctor.
Yeah, you know what? Also, you know, that gun that he had, it was a revolver. It had to have only 6 shots in it, and he must have shot at least 12 rounds out of it without reloading.
Maybe he was just a terrible, horrible shot. That's a niggling point. They were all random. Yeah. All those hits were just what he randomly got, you know?
Well, it was basically 2 shots to the torso, 1 to the head, takes him down. Then the next one, 2 shots to the torso, 1 to the head, takes him down. Learn from your mistakes.
Thinking you got to get the torso twice. Actually, I'm going to take back my bad shot thing because he shot past her head.
That's true.
He did the crack shot, you know.
You know, and then that scene in the what's funny is that zombie outbreak scene was kind of added late in the game because the German distributor asked Fulci, hey, make this a zombie movie because those sell really well. So that's why that sequence bad, but it works with the rest of the film because the film itself is so crazy that you just, like, of course there's zombies.
Well,
you know?
Could show, and in Germany you could just make the poster art, you know, the zombies coming through the hospital wall.
I think they also prefaced it with the whole idea of when the gates of hell opened, or when those doors that the dead would walk the earth. Unless that was something that was added sort of in post, but they mentioned that prior to the actual zombies coming along.
Yeah, so it works in the film because there are no rules, so anything will work. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting always, what's funny to me personally about that bit is where Al Kleiber gets his. Where the glass door blows up and then he gets the giant shards of glass embedded in his face. A number of years ago, back when I was in school, my future wife and I, we were living in an apartment off campus, and this was right at the end of the semester, so it was finals. And I didn't have any tests that day or any tests for like a couple of days. I didn't even have to study for anything. Now, anyone who's familiar, and I doubt very many are, with Clemson University, it's very hard to park as a commuter. It's relatively easy to park if you're a resident, like you live on campus, but if you live off campus, parking is rather tough and can lead to a lot of walking. So what I did was I went and I parked, I drove her to campus so she could take her test, and then I parked in one of the lab lots so that I could just keep an eye on the car and move it if parking services came. And so I just went to a computer lab and brought my copy of The Beyond with me and sat in the back of the lab in a corner watching my movie, you know, waiting for her to get done with her test. So I'm watching The Beyond and I'm just having a, you know, good time. Got my headphones on, not bothering anybody. Behind me in the lab, there's a series of tables where people could lay out their work and you know, get their books out and such. And right as that scene happens, where the glass explodes and flies into Al Kleiber's face, I don't know if the guy just happened to look up, or maybe he heard it through my headphone or something. He looked up and I hear the guy goes, wow, that looks like it hurts. I had to turn around and say, I gave the guy a thumbs up. I was like, I'll always think now, that hurts every time I see it. So
I will admit, throughout this film, the gore effects were probably some of the most disturbing that I've seen in any of these Italian horror films. I mean, it could just be that there were multiple eye gouging scenes, which always kind of make me cringe. But the even Dickie attacking, coming back to rip her throat out.
Well, obviously, if you're in an Italian movie, never trust a seeing eye dog. We're learning that.
Mm-hmm. We had that in Suspiria as well.
That scene is a direct homage to Suspiria on purpose, with the stick guy. It was a guy in Suspiria, but the seeing eye dog tearing out the throat of its owner,
of the blind. Yeah,
I never knew that seeing eye dogs could be trained to attack. That was news to me. That...
Well, they're German shepherds. You've got to think that, you know, they could probably, you know, have two purposes.
Yeah,
why not?
Totally agree. I mean, while watching it, I believe it. It does, of course, raise the question, what the hell is going on with Emily in that film? Is she a ghost? Is she, you know, why does she warn Liza? Why is Schweik trying to take her back? Why does a dog kill a ghost if she is a ghost? And all these questions that are raised that we don't get answers to. And it makes me think of the guy from Halloween 3 who says, a good magician doesn't reveal his tricks. So obviously, the running the gate of hell are good magicians.
Well, and also, you know, there was the transference of the blindness and the creepy eyes from one person to another. So how did, you know, you kind of wonder, is that possession of some sort, or is that something that hell unleashes on one of its servants or one of its messengers or something? So, yeah. Weird.
Hell seemed whatever hell was doing, it seemed to, like, those spiders acted with intent, you know, so it seemed to just sort of at will take whoever it wanted, and it was basically the forces of hell just toying with everybody and killing them until the end.
the end itself, where
and
Lotta end up in the titular beyond. You know, the thing that you need to bring in with background is this, is that Fulci was a, I'm going to use a term that's an oxymoron to me, a devout atheist. And the visual of the beyond, which is the setup for the whole film, because that is what Schweik is painting at the beginning in the prologue. The whole look of the beyond is what Fulci imagined afterlife would be for an atheist. So that there is some kind of an afterlife, but it's not, you know, heaven. It's not hell. It's simply this wasteland, with the bodies, you know, basically rotting to the point that they're part of the landscape. And as far as you can see in every direction, there's nothing. It's just this desolate area. And the way I've always looked at it is that right then is when Liza and John's eyes get the cataracts. That, you know, having, if you look upon the beyond. If you see that your vision goes, you know, if you're, whether you're like Jill or Liza or John, and you're alive and you see it, and then you're part of it, you know, I'm just assuming that when all the zombies and everything was going down, when her mom got her head burned off with acid, that's Jill caught a glimpse of the beyond, or whether you're an escapee from the beyond like Emily. That it just seeing that sears it, you know, sears your vision away, kind of thing. And I love that look. I love Schweik's painting of it. And I think
if
he realized it's so creepy with the bodies all piled and everything, it's like, oh man, that's a great visual.
It reminds me of Rod Serling's Night Gallery.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Very much so.
It also, you know, even though you know, Fulci was an atheist, it does have some callbacks to a lot of Dante's work, like in the Inferno, the kind of stuff that he would depict, going through hell with. So, it is a creepy visual.
What was the painting? Hieronymus Bosch?
Yeah, Hieronymus Bosch, where he had the sort of melting people and
dioramas,
you know,
of hell.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That really bothered me, actually. I was really kind of affected by that point when they actually got there. I was like, as a Catholic, this would really suck if this is what hell is like. That just, just so empty.
Right.
You know?
I'm
hopeless.
I'm in the same boat here. I'm Catholic as well. And it's like, there's absolutely nothing. It's like I said, just a pure wasteland. And at that point, the film has just been driving these graphic of intense visuals at you for 90 minutes of, you know, dismemberment and death and, you know, is it eyeballs being destroyed and the living dead. And Schweik is one of my, I love Schweik as a zombie. I think he's got a great look. The scene with him crucified against the wall in the bathroom is another just visual. And it's just us. And here's the thing, great thing about that scene. Liza goes into that room. Schweik is nailed to the bathroom. It's lightning and stormy and thundering outside. We smash cut to when she runs downstairs. It's now sunny. And it's like, but it's, what is it, an accident? Is it on purpose? It doesn't matter. because it all rolls up into this into the conceit of the film, which is that, like I said, it's the laws of physics are gone. And you're awake, but you're having a nightmare.
This one I would have had a riot. This one would have really gotten me. I was really enjoying it just for the sheer mix of visuals and music. But like, if I saw this at the same age when I saw Phantasm, I probably wouldn't have liked it as much as Phantasm. But it probably would have scared the hell out of me, creeped the hell out of me, you know?
Yeah.
I think those kind of, it's funny because it's not for kids at all, but I think it would really like work to its full extent on the logic of a kid's brain.
Now, I want to go back to the one thing you were talking about, the crucifixion, which, you know, I found interesting of Schweik in the bathroom, that when the people back in 1929, was it, came back to crucify him, they did it, and this is even more disturbing than, you know, the way it's usually depicted, they did it the actual way that supposedly the Romans did it.
Through the wrists, yeah.
Through the wrist, because, you know, you nail someone through the hand, all that is...
It's gonna tear.
Random bones, it's going to tear out. You do it between the wrist, you're going right between the ulna and the radius of your, you know, forearm, and that's how you hold people up there. So I thought that was, you know, I don't know whether that was Fulci just being even more horrific or him trying to be more realistic in his depiction of it, but
hey,
yeah, that
hey, just... it's probably more painful through the wrist, yeah? Do it through the wrist.
I always love that the prologue is shot at sepia tone. So it looks
like it.
20 minutes of The Wizard of Oz, you know, yeah, if The Wizard of Oz is a nightmarish hell.
I threw this thing on and I literally said to myself, holy sepia tone, because it was, oh my god.
And the, in the German cut of The Beyond actually has that in color, so we get to see, in a sense, I'm glad that that's in sepia tone, because of all the stuff that comes after that, I don't know that anything is as painful to watch as that scene with Schweik being whipped with the chain. And I'm squirming watching it, and I know what's coming. So being whipped with the chain, then, like Sean said, being nailed to the wall in a crucifix.
Then having lime boiling and lime.
His face, and it's like, oh my god. And these are guys that they feel that they're justified because Schweik is a warlock. He is painting, you know, an image of the afterlife, and you know, the Book of Aben is there saying that this is one of the doorways to hell. It's like, yeah, would have thought this out better. I'd have taken him someplace else to kill him. Just throwing it out there for future reference, you know.
But, yeah. You know what's funny is this. Now I didn't think of it while I was watching it, but there's a few. It's got a few things in common with Roman Polanski's Ninth Gate.
Yeah.
Movie, with the book and. Just
yeah. Well, the Book of Aben was actually not created for this movie. That was from. A later writer who wrote I don't have his name here in my notes, who wrote stories based in the Lovecraft universe. Book of Aben itself is a relic of a Lovecraftian type of background, so that makes perfect sense again for this, with the unleashing of unknown and incomprehensible terror from a world just separated from ours by, you know, just a barrier. That's a very Lovecraftian sort of technique of storytelling.
Yeah.
And again, so far as story is told in this film, and I don't want to overstate that, of all the films that we've watched, far and away, this one is the one that is a style over substance. Even a film like Deep Red, which is very stylistic and very beautifully shot, Deep Red had a fairly involved story of the whodunit. This does not. I mean, it gets to the point where, honestly, if you need to get up and get yourself a drink in this film, unless you miss one of the gore set pieces, you're not going to be lost.
You're okay.
Because
even more so than like Bay of Blood, this one, the plot really isn't all that, is kind of inconsequential to the whole thing. It's the set pieces. And like we've said before, it feels like a nightmare. You can just go from one scene to the next and just go with it because that's how dreams and nightmares work. So yeah, amazing.
And that's why I said at the intro, it's the two films that are always bandied about as Fulci's best film are Zombie and The Beyond. Depending on what day of the week you ask me, I'm going to have a different opinion just because I love them both, even though they are so different from each other. The Zombie was, again, not the most original story, but definitely driven by the narrative. Whereas here, like Sean, you just said, narrative is almost inconsequential. So but one of the reasons that I really wanted to watch this one as part of this was to show, again, an aspect that we see a lot in not just Italian, but in European horror in general, that sometimes you need to just have a gore show and you know, not worry so much about writing the great American horror film or the great Italian horror film in this case, and just really just set the audience on edge with mood and lighting and sound and color and imagery more so than anything else. This is, if anything, a celebration of mise-en-scène over narrative.
Yeah.
Which is hard to do in American cinema, but seems easier to pull off in European cinema.
It's definitely sends you home with more than your average movie's share of images in your head. Gruesome, horrifying images too.
Oh yeah. Yeah, this, you know, this, I mean, this is one of those ones that I would show my friends when we were at school, and they'd be like, you know, and it would just get a huge response from all the gore and everything else. But the one of the scenes that stands out to me as being one of the most effective shots in the film has no gore in it at all, and that is when Liza and John finally decide to get the hell out of Dodge and flee from the hotel. And they run outside and get in the car and head out. And then suddenly all the lights start coming on in the hotel. And the hotel that has been vacant for 60 years now is filled with activity. And, you know, are they the dead? Are they ghosts? Are they... You don't know. It's just the suddenly lit up hotel. And, you know, little things like that I like. Because, again, it's a creative little touch that just adds to the overall spookiness of the whole thing.
I agree.
Yes.
So, I was very interested to get your guys' take on this because this is said just Roger Ebert, for instance, despised this film.
Oh, he must have hated this. Yeah, Siskel probably hated it too.
Oh yeah,
it's there's some amazing visuals in it, and like I said, the end really struck me. Again, it's a thing where I find the music out of place. The dubbing always takes me out when it's like, oh, it's really bad in this one. But I mean, I didn't hate it. I did find some of it a kind of a slog to get through when there wasn't something wicked happening on screen. But I mean, I guess, you know,
you didn't
that's
have to
the
wait
thing.
Long
it's just,
anyway.
It's just the loosest, you know, bit of not even plot, but of just connective tissue to get you to the next. You know, tableau that they want to present, but I don't know. I don't think I'll be too keen on rewatching it just because it's not really, it doesn't really hit what I'm looking for usually in a horror film. But
I'd like to
I think
see
it's a, you know,
Fulci's worst movie. Just see what what that is.
He made some mistakes. I mean, Fulci was always working at a lower end. Than some of his contemporaries were, and he made some poor films later on in his career. So, Voices from Beyond comes to mind as a film that's just, you want to talk about a film that just kind of leaden and doesn't really go anywhere and doesn't even have the visuals like one of his other films. Yeah. Fulci was making films pretty much right up until he died. So he's got there's a large body of work for him. That and a lot of them kind of fall underneath the Demonia is another one that's just it's like and that's one that just kind of ends because they've run out of film kind of thing.
Sounds like a DiMonzo production, yeah.
Exactly. And
did he do a fantasy sword and sorcery flick?
Yes.
Or
yes,
am I mistaken?
Was,
Conquest, is that the name of it?
Yeah.
Is that him or is that?
No,
I've been. If I'm wrong.
Conquest.
I don't know.
After New York Ripper.
It just, it sounds interesting enough to where I'd want to see it, but who knows?
I mean, you know, Fulci did films all across the board. I mean, besides his horror is what he's known for, but he did action films like Contraband, and he did post-apocalyptic movies like For the Apocalypse, Warriors of the Year 2072. He did comedies. He did like real crime, like true crime movies, like the New York Ripper is usually lumped in with his horror stuff, but really it's a police procedural that happens to be just brutally violent. He did Giallo, like A Lizard in a Woman's Skin, and Don't Torture a Duckling, were two of his early Giallos. I mean, he did a spy movie, 002, Operation Moon. So, I mean, Fulci did the entire breadth, but everybody only remembers him for his ones with, you know, dismemberment and people being ripped apart by various...
It sounds like he just liked to work. It sounds like he was just trying to, like, give me something to work on.
That exact phrase is one my wife and I often bandy about. Like, we'll see some actor or actress that you see them in everything. And it's like, you know, they like to work, you know? They're not one of these guys that only does a movie when their visa bill is too high that month, you know?
Or when it's the perfect script or anything. It's just like, oh, well, hey, this one's timed really well. I'm about ready to get out of the house for a couple months.
Like, what are we shooting? Okay, sounds good.
The entire career of Whoopi Goldberg.
I was gonna say, hey, kind of fits that one as well, you know? I'll do it, whatever, man.
As long as I got my weed and my bongos.
And if they can do a scene where I don't get to wear a shirt,
that's gravy.
Oh boy!
But one thing I do want to point out is, you know, we often talk about things that get lost in translation. In the autopsy chamber, what does the big sign on the door say? Do not entry.
Yep, I caught that too.
I had, without hyperbole, I had "Do Not Entry" posted on the bath. When I was in school, I always lived in a dorm room that was set up like a suite. So you had two rooms that were sharing one bathroom, mm-hmm. right? And on my bathroom door in every dorm room I ever lived in, I put a giant sign that said "Do Not Entry." And Ruben said, "What does that mean?" It's like, well, you're not going to watch the movie that it's in, so just roll with it.
Yeah.
Until I finally got somebody who was in my room with a friend of mine, and he's like, oh, that's awesome. Well, we're finished up with Fulci after these two. I think this gives a good overview of the kind of films that Lucio Fulci made. If you liked Zombie and you liked The Beyond, there are some other ones that I'd recommend. The two spiritual follow-ups to The Beyond are both good. Those are City of the Living Dead, also known as Gates of Hell.
I've seen that one.
Yes, and that one has... If you thought the splinter scene in in Zombie was kind of excruciating to watch, there's one in City of the Living Dead that puts that to shame as far as how he manages to drag it out. Just... And on and it pays off. And that's another one that has a lot of visuals and not the most concise of stories. I made the mistake of first watching Gates of Hell while I was enjoying a few adult beverages. And in one sense, it made it very enjoyable, but the other sense, I got real confused at some point. So.
Hey you! Don't watch that! Watch this! This is the heavy, heavy monster sound! The nuttiest sound around! So if you're coming off the street and you're beginning to feel the heat, well listen, Buster, you better start to move your feet to the rockin'est, rock-steady beat of madness! One step beyond!
Mm-hmm.
visit our website at twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
Two True Freaks and all of its excellent affiliates are available on iTunes, and you can choose to subscribe to either the entire network if you wish, or pick whichever individual shows you want to follow. We have so many shows to choose from, there's just bound to be one that appeals to your particular fandom. Just search Two True Freaks with an exclamation mark at the end, space, and the number 2.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks. If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks?
If you've enjoyed our show, please, won't you take a moment to rate us on iTunes? That helps others find the show, too.
Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
We were finally invited aboard one of these spacecraft, which landed near Ann Arbor, Michigan on October the 24th of 1954. This is a drawing of the craft. As I was leaving the craft, the commander, Soltek, said, "Soon others of your people will be able to have an experience similar to this."